This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 65. Got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking mead with the folks from Moonlight Meadery. I got a couple of quick announcements. Obviously, our desktop and mobile versions of Beersmith are out now. The big thing I want to remind you is some of our other websites that we have. We have the Beersmith blog at beersmith.com/blog, where you can find not only all 65 episodes of this podcast, but I've actually got several hundred brewing articles there on beer brewing of all kinds. And the other thing I want to mention is beersmithrecipes.com, which is a recipe site, recipe sharing site that I launched about a year ago. And that's up to some 118,000 recipes, which you can use and research and search. So a great resource there. And we have rating systems as well, so you can find some of the top recipes that other homebrewers enjoy. And now, without further ado, let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Michael Fairbrother from Moonlight Meadery. Michael has been making mead since 1995 and eventually won both national and international awards. In early 2010, he launched Moonlight Meadery on a full-time basis, and he's been making commercial mead these past 3 years. His website is at moonlightmeadery.com. Michael, it's great to have you back on the show.
Great to see you again, Brad.
I think this is your second time, right?
Yes, sir.
So I met you back in, it was 2011, I think, at the National Homebrew Conference.
Yeah, we just happened to be having lunch at the same table and struck up a conversation.
Yeah, and then you started telling me a story. It was kind of interesting. We both started full-time about the same time, I think, if I recall. Yeah. You started in 2010, right?
Yeah, May of 2010, we started our first commercial batch.
Well, I didn't quit till July, so I quit my job in July. But
Then we're right on the same track. I quit my day job on July 8th, 2010.
Mine was July 1st, so I beat you by a couple of days. But,
nice.
But anyways, you've been doing this full-time for over 3 years now. And how's it going? How's the meadery business? Because a lot of people aren't even familiar with mead.
Yeah, it's been absolutely incredible. We just got our first commercial order from Australia this morning, or 2 days ago, and it's all wrapped, ready to go. We're just waiting on payment. And once we get the payment, we're shipping our first international order out. And fans from Australia will be able to get our meads. We're now distributed in over 27 states here in the United States. And I don't know what to tell you.
I want to put that in perspective. You started your business in your garage, right?
Yeah, we have my garage is about 20 by 25 feet. And now we have a 4,000 square foot production facility. We have capacity to make over 400,000 bottles per year right now. I used to joke with my wife that we're the largest craft meadery in the country, but I guess it's going to become the world very soon.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, are you actually the largest? I have no idea. Are you really?
I think we're coming close. It's we shipped out over 8,000 cases this year. We're still expecting another multi-thousand case order coming in any day now from our brand agent, which will put us over 10,000 cases for the year, which is double from what we did last year.
Wow. So, I mean, just in 3 years, you've been doubling almost every year. Actually, even more than doubling every year.
Yeah, the first year we went to 1,000 cases. Last year was a little over 5,000. And we've already doubled last year's numbers at this point. And it's just going north.
So how'd you get started mead making? Because, you know, a lot of people don't even know what mead is, I think, when I talk to my friends and so on.
Yeah, I was at a party back in 1995. I'd started homebrewing beer and the Boston Word Processors and Brew Free or Die. I was having a joint summer party, and somebody offered me a sizer. Now, I never tried a sizer before, and I had no idea what it was, but I didn't want to embarrass myself. So I said, sure. Now, if you've ever seen a baby try something for the first time, you see its face light right up. Well, that was me, and I was like 29 years old, and I'm like, what is this stuff? And the gentleman said, it's apple mead. I'm like, what is mead? And he said, it's wine made from honey. I'm like, wait a second. I used to be a beekeeper. How do you make wine from honey? And he walked me through the process. And I went home and started trying to figure out how to make it. The average convention back then was it took several years to make a decent batch.
Right.
And I just kept working at it really hard until I was it around 2006 as president of the largest homebrew club here in New Hampshire, Brew Free or Die. Mm-hmm. And I realized when I pulled out bottles of beer, my buddies were hanging out. And when I pulled out a bottle of mead that I was making, everyone in the room was knocking somebody over. And I said, there's got to be a business for this. And we make over a little over 70 varieties now. We're playing with, you know, everything from traditional meads, which are honey and water, to melomels, which are meads made with the addition of fruit, to methaglens, which are meads with spices, barrel-aged meads. We've got a lambic mead coming up not too distant future. We want to make a really hoppy mead. So, you know, anything that you can imagine and think of is what I'm playing with. It's, for me, it's all just a massive amount of doing exactly what I want to do and having a lot of fun at doing it.
Very cool. So you make 70 different kinds of mead. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of mead? A lot of people don't know that mead predates beer, probably, right?
Yeah, mead history, there's a cave painting that shows man harvesting honey from a beehive. The best guess on the painting dates are 20,000 years ago. So 20,000 wow. years ago, there was an awful lot going on. There was no agriculture, so nobody was growing grain or hops. Most likely think of hunting and gathering. Now, when you take honey from a beehive, you have to figure out how you're going to protect that honey from those bees. Because bees will come back and take it. We had a honey spill here at the meadery where we lost about 10 gallons of honey. And I got the clever idea, well, we'll just squeegee it out the back door. And over 100,000 bees showed up and cleaned up every ounce of that honey. So that's where I got to thinking about, you know, how could this have come about? And the thought process I had was that somebody got the clever idea to put it in water. And when you put honey in the water sits on top of the honey. So you can reach down in between the water and honey to grab more honey and eat it as you like. But the bees can't smell the honey at that point. Now, when water sits on top of honey, it causes it to start diluting. And as it dilutes, it starts to ferment, and the rest is history. So, you know, you fast forward into the Middle Ages, mead becomes known as nectar of the gods. And I challenge my customers and say, who would give it such a name like that? I mean, really, how does nectar of the gods come to be the moniker for this beverage? It's because they wanted it for themselves. They didn't want other people to drink it. And so the elite and the noble and the rich kept mead for themselves, and everybody else really forgot about it until, you know, other meaderies started coming around and really kind of recrafting and rebuilding this brand new craft industry. And what we've done in 3 years, I never saw it being this successful. I just had a dream and kept working on it. And, you know, I don't know how to even describe what we've done and how we do it, but it's listeners and viewers like yours that really kind of pull it through for us and really kind of ask for our product all across the country.
So, Michael, was it a difficult decision to quit your day job?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, in July 7th of 2010, the first batch was ready, and the entire batch sold out in one day. So the next day, I got up and I said, that's it. I'm done. And it was pretty terrifying. And there's an awful lot of fear in the risk of losing your house and everything you've worked your life to have. And it's not for the faint of heart, but it was something I would do again in a second.
Yeah, one of the moments I remember is when I actually got my last paycheck. And it it wasn't even the financial thing because, you know, I had some money in the bank and everything's good and I had some money coming in, but it was so scary to think, you know, for 20 something years I had a paycheck and now I didn't have a paycheck anymore.
Yeah, it's really hard when you get used to that comfort and now there's no comfort, you know, and what do you do about that and what drives you? You know, every business owner will tell you that, you know, there is no secret success for everybody. It's a determination. It's the power of the will to never take no for an answer. It's a million and one things. But we're starting to work on a book proposal that should be coming out in the next couple of years. So we met with our agent this morning and things are starting to move along.
That's fantastic. What kind of book are you doing?
It's pretty much going to be a, you know, how to start a meadery, you know, what, you know, the entrepreneurial aspect of it. The challenges that one faces as they come into the industry, you know, and how to get through all the red tape that exists and how to define a brand, build a brand, you know, basically go from your garage to worldwide distribution in 3 years.
Well, let's see. You were an award-winning mead maker long before you started. How is mead making different from home brewing?
So home brewing, you're pretty much, for the most part, going to be boiling the mash or the wort, either whether you're making it from extract or you're making it from all grain. The process, once you've gotten to your wort ready and chilled, that's where we start. So we mix honey with water to dilute it or juice, depending on whether we're making a traditional mead or a melomel. So if you're going to make a traditional mead, the type of honey really matters. And the flavor from that honey will really carry through into the finished product. So whether it's wildflower honey or orange blossom honey or tupelo blossom honey, mm-hmm. or any number of different types of honey, they all add different characteristics to the mead. Now, my preferred mead of honey of choice is orange blossom. It's certainly very tasty, works great with methaglins. For making melomels, for the most part, we use wildflower honey, but we will use orange blossom honey for our strawberry rhubarb mead that we make, which has a just nice, light, citrusy note from the orange blossom honey. So we dilute the honey, which we usually raise to about 80 degrees just so that we can pump it through a pump. But if you're a home brewer, you could start with about 18 gallons of honey.
18 pounds. Sorry, 18 pounds, right? You said gallons. So I said 18 gallons of honey would be a lot.
Yeah, 18 gallons of honey is a ton. So it's 12 pounds of a gallon. So 18 pounds of honey. So a gallon and a half. And you can dilute that with a 4-gallon, 4.5-gallon batch of cool water. Whisk it together, to dilute it. And once you've got it diluted, you want to add staggered nutrients.
Mm-hmm. Let's start from the very beginning. So let's start at the very beginning. Say I want to make a 5-gallon batch of sweet mead, for example.
Okay.
How would I start? First of all, let's start with the ingredients. What would I need to get?
First thing you're going to need to get is 1.5 gallons of honey. So 18 pounds of honey.
18 pounds of honey.
Yeah, you want to contact your local beekeeper or try to find. We only use True Source certified honey, which means that it's ethically sourced, sustainable, traceable all the way back to the beehives.
And what's a good source for that? Because obviously I can't go in a grocery store and buy 18 pounds of honey, and I probably don't want it if I buy it either.
Yeah, we buy our honey through Pennsylvania Dutch Gold or Dutch Gold Honey. You can go to dutchgold.com. I know they've worked with a lot of homebrewers. They had a booth at the American Homebrewers Conference this year. Really, really love to see homebrewers working with them. They've been big supporters of homebrew competitions in the past.
I think you mentioned the beekeepers also have a website at one point.
Yeah, you can go to honeylocator.com, I believe, mm-hmm. or honey.com, and from there you can get to the Honey Locator website. And that'll give you a great way to search for specific varietals of honey flower, flower honeys. And it's the best way to go about it.
And who supplies them, right? I mean, there's also a list of suppliers there, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And you'd like to get something like an orange blossom or wildflower to start with, right?
Yeah, you want it to be as fresh as possible. So your ideal is if you can get honey right from the beekeeper and take it to your fermentation area and mix it up and get it going, it's perfect. Because honey, it's full of natural enzymes. We do not denature these enzymes by boiling the honey. There's a huge religious debate on whether you should boil or not. For us, we never boil. We only warm it up to 80 degrees so we can move it from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. At that point, we're adding cold water, and mm-hmm. we have a professional grade mixer at this point. So it's, we can mix honey with right. ice cold water if we wanted to.
So honey's the first ingredient. Obviously you need good water, right?
Yeah, water has to be clean and good to taste. So you can't use water that has a lot of chlorine in it, can't have a high mineral content.
Yeah, so like I've got a well with high mineral content, probably wouldn't work well. I'd have to go with bottled water or something, right?
Yeah, the best bet is if you love drinking your water off the tap and it doesn't taste bad, you're fine. If you're like, oh, I can't even make coffee with this water, it tastes so bad, forget it. Go buy bottled water.
Okay.
We're here in New Hampshire. We're blessed with great water source. And it's, drives me crazy to see people buying bottled water when the tap water is so great, but to each their own.
And then the yeast you use?
We use specifically a white wine yeast. It's called Lavelin 71B. It's from Narrebone, France. Any home brewer can go pick this up in a homebrew shop. But I've had good success with Lavlin's 47D and 71B.
So 71B, and that's a dry yeast, if I recall, right?
Yes, that's correct. So you're going to want to rehydrate the yeast first. You can go to Scott Labs. Their website has a great how-to on how to rehydrate yeast. That should be a reference material for any home brewer on the planet for how to rehydrate yeast and what the pros and cons of doing that.
So that's it. 5 gallons of water, right? 18 pounds of honey and some good yeast, right?
Yeah, it's going to be about, 3.5 gallons of water, I think, with 1.5 gallons of honey.
Oh, I forgot to mention the nutrients. You're going to need some kind of nutrients, right? What right. do you use for nutrients?
This stupid chair makes it enough already.
That's okay.
We use We use GoFirm and Fermaid K, which are both sources of nitrogen. What you're trying to do for the first 3 days of after you've got the honey and water mixed up and the yeast pitched is to give the yeast enough nutrients so that they can grow very fast and very rapidly, so that when they've got, you know, essentially 3 days in, they go attack all this honey, and you're going to get in a very nice clean fermentation.
So that's that staggered nutrient schedule you're going to talk about in just a minute, right?
Right.
How do you, do you use equal parts of GoFirm and Fermaid K? Is that what you do? Or
yeah, we take essentially about a tablespoon of each, and then we divide it into four
pieces, right?
Four portions. So the first portion goes in when you're mixing the rehydrating yeast. Then you're pitching every 24 hours for the first 3 days, and not pitching yeast, but adding the nutrients at that point for the first 3 days. And then when it's about two-thirds away finished completion, you add the last batch of nutrients. Now, the trick when you're using nutrients is to never add them dry. If you add nutrients dry to a batch of mead that has yeast that is growing or possibly fermenting, it's going to cause a nucleation point and the whole vat's going to pretty much come out and over the top. So you want to be careful with that, especially...
You have a mead bomb.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend using a bucket. So to focus with, so you can take the top off, take a little bit of that mead, rehydrate your nutrients, stir it up, and then gently add it back in. So for the first 3 days, adding a little bit of oxygen into the must isn't going to hurt it at all. It's going to actually help continue to make that yeast grow versus ferment.
Okay, so switching over to equipment, you mentioned using a bucket. Most homebrewers probably already have all the equipment they need to make mead, right?
Yeah, it shouldn't take anything different. I mean, our first batches as commercial meadery were all made in 5 gallon glass carboys.
So you could do a 5 gallon gas carboy, you could do a 5 gallon bucket with a top, right?
Exactly.
You just need a fermenter, basically, with an airlock, right?
Yes, and we try to control the temperature. Now, at a homebrew scale, you're not going to have too much challenge, but you want it to keep it in the low 60s or you know, under 70.
So maybe wrap a towel around it, wet towel around it or something, get the temperature down a little, keep it in the basement, that kind of a thing?
Exactly.
Okay. So we walked through, the ingredients, we walked through the equipment. We started on the procedure, but... You mentioned you start cold, with cold honey and cold water, right? You don't necessarily have to heat it up.
Yeah, you could certainly try, if I was going to do it, you shouldn't have to be worried about it getting it exactly all mixed up. So if you can get the majority of the honey and the majority of the water blended together, you're in good stead. I mean, I've actually did a test batch on a homebrew scale where I had 2.5 gallons of honey sitting on the
sitting on the bottom.
Yeah, not gallons, inches of honey sitting on the bottom. And I measured every day how much the yeast was actually consuming the honey so I could actually, you know, keep track of it. So it's an interesting experience to watch. And that's, again, gently feeding the yeast to, you know, just enough honey for them to ferment. So it's kind of, I guess there's pros and cons to doing it. But, you know, I don't think I do every single batch that way.
So you're going to mix your honey and water together. You're going to hydrate the yeast. I think you mentioned that was important.
Yes.
You're going to add the nutrients, right?
Correct.
And mix those in a big bucket, and that's your brew day right there. I mean, it takes not very long, right?
You could probably do it in less than an hour.
Less than an hour. So instead of a 3 or 4 hour process I might go through to do an all-grain beer, I can have my mead started in less than an hour.
You could probably make a whole batch in about 25 minutes.
Probably the longest part is hydrating the yeast. Probably takes 15, 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, because you're temperating the yeast to the water and everything.
Right. So. Typically, you add some warm water when you're hydrating the yeast and let it sit for 15, 20 minutes. I think you mentioned you like to use honey as well.
Yeah, we'll pitch. You're probably going to make like a 2-cup starter to rehydrate your yeast. And we probably use 2 or 3 tablespoons of honey added to that just to give the yeast a little bit of a sugar source while they're rehydrating.
So you pitch the yeast and now you just let it sit for a day before you add the next portion of yeast nutrient, right?
Right. So at that point, you'd want to take off the lid. You'd take a small, probably with a wine leaf, take a small portion out and rehydrate your nutrients, mix those up, and then gently, stir those into the must. Put the lid back on 24 hours later, do the same process again. 24 hours later, again, the same process. So, the whisking of the mead at that point, you're adding a little bit of oxygen. So while there's oxygen still in the must, the yeast is basically trying to grow to consume all the oxygen. And then once it's done, at that point, you let it go until it's, pretty much finished. And then you can add the last.
Yeah, you said 2/3 fermented. I guess you just measure the gravity periodically or something like that to figure out when it's down there.
Yeah, you'd be looking at like 1.5 to 2 weeks at that point. Yeah, it's the rough ballpark of when you could expect it to be close.
Now, one of the cool things about the procedure you're describing is you can make mead a lot faster than you used to be able to. I know when I started home brewing, and just like you, it took 1.5 years, maybe 2 years, sometimes at least 1 year to make a good mead. And that's not true anymore, is it?
No, we're releasing batches at 3 months at this point. So the youngest they go out the door is 3 months. And we've seen, the competition where I won Best of Show, it came out of the fermenter, went into the competition, won first place out of 353 entries at 3 months to the day.
Fantastic. So I walk through, I add these nutrients, I let it ferment for how long? How long should I let it ferment before I attempt to bottle or do anything else with it?
Yeah, we'll take it from primary into secondary at 3 months' time. And so you're basically racking it off the yeast bed at that point. And what we're trying to do is let it get as naturally clear as possible. Depending on the yeast and whether you're making a hydromel or a melomel, or you should see it looking pretty clear by that point. And if it's not, you just need to rack it a few more times, and that's going to drop the clarity of the mead. You want it absolutely crystal clear. You can always filter the meads if you want, or you have the equipment to do so. A little bit of finings might help, but time will definitely get it to where you need it to go. Homebrewers can make carbonated meads rather easy. You just need to be careful not to create bottle bombs, because honey ferments at a much slower rate than traditional beers or wines that they might have experience with. I took a mead that I made 3 years ago at my house, brought it to the meadery to bottle it up for gifts, and it's carbonated just from bottling it. So, there's something that it really should have been a long time done, and it came out quite effervescent.
Well, I mean, that's an important point. So when you bottle it, is there anything you can add to try and keep it from ferment? Because, as you pointed out, most meads will continue to ferment if you just throw them in the bottle.
We've gone.
If you're looking for a still mead, you may not want that, right?
Right. We actually now use potassium sorbate and metabisulfite to stabilize everything we bottle here at the meadery at this point. So unlike a traditional winery that might add sulfites when they get the grapes in-house, and then as they transfer each batch, we only add the sulfites and sorbates at the very end of the process, right before bottling, just to make sure that we have a stable product that's consistent.
And that stabilizes it so that it won't ferment any farther, right?
Yes.
So you recommend if you're trying to make a still mead, maybe add some of those. And you can find those. Can you find those in your local homebrew store? Is that something you can get pretty easily?
Yeah, it shouldn't be hard to come by. There's standard tables that you can calculate. You might need a pH strip or a pH meter to measure the pH because it's all a basis scale based on what the pH is. So when homebrewers ask me, well, how much should I add? Like, well, you got to go look it up, just like I do every time we're making a batch.
So, but these are used in winemaking, so they are pretty common.
Yes.
Is there anything else you need to do different when bottling a mead, for example?
No.
I mean, can you bottle it with a regular capper? Do I need to go out and buy a cork machine? I mean, what?
No, you can. I mean, I've got cases, probably 12 to 13 cases worth of bottled mead at the house that are all in beer bottles with regular standard caps. The interesting thing when you're capping them is if you do get one that tends to carbonate or maybe haven't added the sulfites and sorbates, you can always burp the bottle just a little bit to let the gas out as it's building up and, you know, easier to refrigerate, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there's still mead and there's also carbonated mead, right?
Yeah, there's three styles.
Sparkling, I guess, right?
Yeah, enter into homebrew competitions. You have still, slightly carbonated, and sparkling.
So we walked through how to make a basic sweet mead. What are some of the other variants that that people enjoy?
So our Kurt's Apple Pie, which is an open category, so category 26C, is we take honey, instead of adding water, we're adding fresh pressed apple cider. We use a combination between Macintosh and Gallows and a few other apples here in New Hampshire. And what we'll do is same ratio, so 18 pounds of honey, 3.5 gallons of cider. We let that ferment to completion, same nutrient regime. And then we'll add Vietnamese cinnamon and Madagascar bourbon vanilla beans. We'll add approximately one vanilla bean in a 5 gallon batch. And about a teaspoon of Vietnamese cinnamon in a 5 gallon batch. And then we let it age to taste, you know, to where we like the flavor. And from that point, we'll filter and bottle. Yeah,
I've had that. It is quite good. It really does taste like apple pie too, which is the amazing thing. It's like drinking an apple pie.
That is clearly our best seller.
But I know you make a whole bunch of other varieties. Let's talk about fruits for a minute. How would you go about mixing fruits in? Because I know many popular meads use a lot of fruit.
So you have three choices. You could go get fresh fruit from a farm or a farmer's market. You can chop that up. For blueberries, we used to always freeze. You know, I like to freeze fruit because it just gives you a nice cell membrane breakdown.
Right.
So whether it's blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, you know, we always pre-freeze those. The other option is you can go down to your local gourmet store and pick up some just juice. I used to use the R.W. Kunsten just blackcurrant juice, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I pick up the just blackcurrant, blueberry, and cherry. And that's how I came up with our triple berry, what's called now Desire mead. So instead of water,
another popular
juice.
One. I think I drank a case of that in the last year or so. Enjoyed that.
Yeah, that one's definitely that's our second bestseller. And then the other option you have is concentrate. The challenges with concentrate is that you've got to really kind of know how the flavor is going to change from fresh fruit to concentrate. It's kind of like the difference between fresh squeezed orange juice and, you know, for rehydrated orange juice from concentrate. It's orange. It's different. but it's not the same, and it never will be.
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot of challenges around how do you make a product consistently. You know, at our scale, you know, now we're having challenges with, you know, do we lose 20% of the batch to take up the, you know, for the blueberry skin pulp, or do we, you know, look at other options? So we've been exploring other options. We're still, you know, like fresh squeezed apple cider, you know, pressed apple cider. We are blessed with apple orchards all around the meadery, so we tend to go as local as we can.
Yeah, I grew up in New York, and you used to be able to get it off the press. Yeah, they would literally pour it right off the press into your into your gallon jug. I don't know if they can do that anymore because pasteurization laws and stuff. But
yeah, it depends on what you're going to use it for. So for us, we buy it unpasteurized.
Yeah,
comes straight off the press, goes right into a 300 gallon tote. We drive it from the orchard over to the winery and blend it that day.
Wow, must be fantastic. And when do you add the fruit? Let's say I'm going to incorporate berries or cider or whatever.
My style is to always add it in primary. I never want to have artificial or non-integrated flavor. So the fermentation process, just like the difference between fresh squeezed orange juice and rehydrated orange juice, tastes different. Meads made with fruit up front taste different than meads made with juice added after the fact. So, you know, adding juice after the fact could cause some fermentation to kick off again. As well as, you know, it'll weaken your mead, so it lowers the alcohol content. We tend to make really high alcohol meads from 15, 16, 17%. We actually have some that are up to 19. And we're really looking to really kind of refine how clean that will taste. So you can't do that if you're adding the fruit at secondary. So by adding fruit in primary, you know, we're using mostly juice at this point. You get that clean integrated flavor that really can't be beat.
So just dump it in right up front, right when you add the honey, right?
Yeah, just replace water almost one for one for juice.
Or fruits or whatever you're using, right?
Correct. And if you're going to use fruit, it's going to float to the top of the fermenter. And what you want to do is to push that fruit cap down, because the fruit's going to form an insulation blanket. So basically the heat from the fermentation is going to get caught right up at the top, and that's going to cook your mead, which is going to make it taste
not so good.
Not so good. It's going to be a spicy hot from the alcohol.
So you get in there and mix it every once in a while, or?
Yeah, two or three times a day would be probably ideal until it gets through the bulk of the fermentation.
Now, going back, I know some people in the modern mead making era, you like to aerate their mead. I'm talking about primary fermentation. They like to aerate it for the first few days. Is that something you do a lot of, or no?
Yeah, we do it religiously.
You do. Okay, so you recommend for that first few days after I pitch the yeast to actually get in. I know some people even use a paint stirrer and a drill. They go that far, but but I mean, you want to, you know, you actually do want to get air. Unlike beer, where, you know, getting air in after the fermentation is really bad. It sounds like having a little oxygen in the thing really helps accelerate the fermentation, right?
Yeah, for your mead, it's definitely a different beast. I mean, I've never tried one of my meads that were oxidized. I suppose it's possible, you know, mishandling after it's left the meadery to where it gets to a consumer store. But, you know, we've never, you know, we strive to have highly consistent, non-fault beverages in the marketplace.
But I wanted to point it out because it's a big difference between making beer. Normally, you know, beer, after you start the fermentation, you definitely don't want to add any oxygen. Whereas at least I've been told the first couple of days, it actually helps fermentation, right?
Right, because you're encouraging the growth of the yeast the first 3 days. So you're really trying to make sure you have such a massive quantity of yeast that it's going to do the job without any effort. So effortlessly.
Now, the only other ingredient I want to cover was spices. I know they're used quite a bit in mead. Again, are those things you add up front, or those things you add at the very end? How do you handle that?
You never want to add spices up front. So the challenge you would have is the fermentation process will scrub out the aromatics. So you want to add spices in secondary. And you want to pick a honey that's going to be very supportive of spice additions. The best that I've seen consistent results with is orange blossom honey. But I've also worked with heather honey and some of the other ones. So the spicing, it's kind of like, you want to paint the picture, but you don't want to make it high definition, right? So you want to have people have the expectation of the spice without hammering it home. It's kind of like the really well-made pumpkin beers aren't like over the top with nutmeg and clove. And it's kind of like the nuance is there, and you can still taste the qualities of the beer that's underneath it. And it's not like you're feeling like the beer is being hidden by the spices. So the same is true with the spicing ratios for meads. Now, you can go over the top. We make one called Breathless, which is almost like an atomic fireball. So really, really rich, deep, deep, fiery, cinnamon, hot, you know, mead. But that one I, in particular, wanted to make that way.
Right.
But we do make another one that's...
Well, it's like people make IPAs with, you know, a couple hundred IBUs of hops, right?
Right, right.
They're not doing it by accident.
No, you can... You know, the subtlety when it's needed and not when you're trying to showcase, you know, here's how insane I can be and here's what I'm doing about it.
Now, what are some of your favorite fruits and spices to work with? I know when you're making beer, certain fruits work really well and certain fruits just don't come through at all.
Yeah, I prefer currants. I really like the way currant can represent in a honey-based product. So currant's like I haven't actually seen the currant. I've seen it on a bush or photos of it on a laptop, but I've never seen a real currant bush.
Black currants, yeah.
Yeah, you got black and red currants. Difference between the two, black currants are more tart, more astringent. Red currants a little softer. I definitely like berries, stone fruits like peaches, nectarines. Yeah, pretty much the whole gamut. I haven't made a mead with watermelon. That's not going to happen anytime soon, or if ever. And for spices, you have to get the best possible spices you can buy. Spend the money to get, you know, go to Pensies or whatever to get the highest grade ingredients you can. You can't make great meads without great ingredients.
How do you do something tough like strawberries? I know you make one with strawberries, and that is strawberry. For those of you who hadn't tried to make beer with strawberries, strawberry is such a subtle flavor. It's almost impossible to get it to come through.
It takes a lot. You're looking at almost 4 pounds per gallon. That's a lot of strawberries. And one of the best strawberry meads I ever tasted from a home brewer out in Minnesota had, you know, he actually strained out the strawberry seeds to avoid the tannins from the strawberry seeds, which, you know, certainly.
Strained out the strawberry seeds. I can't imagine.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. I can't say I've ever come close to trying that.
That's great. I was hoping you could just talk for a few minutes about what you guys have got going on that's new. I know you make 72 varieties, so there's a huge variety for people to try. But I was wondering if you take a few minutes to talk about Moonlight Meteor, where you're headed.
Sure.
What do you got going on?
We've got a brand new two meads that just came out this week or a few weeks ago. Slow Dance, which is a collaboration with Lynn Howard from Brew for Your Die. Mm-hmm. It's a piment, so it's a Cabernet Sauvignon and Orange Blossom.
What's honey. A piment, so people know?
It's a mead that's made with addition of, so it's a melomel, but it's a grape melomel. So grapes are the key ingredient aside, along with the honey. Mm-hmm. And we've also got Destiny, which is a blackcurrant blueberry black cherry that's been aged in our Sam Adams Utopias barrels where we make Utopian, which is a mead that we make. So after we made Utopian, we put the Desire, which is my flagship mead, into the barrel and let that age for an extra year, and that just came on the market as well.
Wow, what do you get that? What do you get out of the barrel if you do that?
Really
different nice flavor.
Yeah, so it dries out the flavor quite a bit more, makes it more closer to a red wine type of body and complexity to it. You get beautiful little bourbony hints off the background, just soft and subtle. Oak will give you a little more vanilla, depending on how long it's in the oak. You can get vanilla and coconut types of notes off of it as well. We are working on a brand new mead, possibly going to go into the market as Bad Apple, which is a apple mead that's for sizer apple and honey that's been aged in fresh Jim Beam bourbon barrels. So, you know, I've been tasting this the last couple of weeks, and this one's going to be probably a whole new design, package, label to toy up, play with that kind of concept.
Wow. Where can people find your meads? I know, you know, one of the problems I have, I go to the store and there is no mead, or there's like one bottle and it's not very good.
Yeah, that's a challenge. We've got distribution in lots of states, but just because you have distribution doesn't mean it's actually getting distributed as I continue to learn on a daily basis. So the key thing is to ask for it. If any of your listeners or viewers live in a state we're not distributed in, we're actively seeking distribution in those states. So they can contact or have their stores or distributors contact our brand manager, who is St. Killian's Importing, and they'd be happy to figure out how to work with them. But otherwise, asking for a product in stores without consumers asking for it, it's going to take a lot longer to ever get it to from point A to point B. We were just down in Baltimore this past week for a tasting event, and we tasted close to 70 different restaurants, stores, and the like. And not one of them said this wasn't going to work for them. So it was a really impressive couple of days to spend down in Baltimore to showcase our product. But, you know, there are states that just, you know, the distribution hasn't bought into the concept that anybody wants this stuff.
I live in Virginia, and I have yet to see it in a store down here, but I was able to go to your website and order it as well. So.
Yes, so absolutely. You can. We can ship to 17 states on our website, pretty much all across the country.
And the website is?
www.moonlightmeadery.com.
Moonlightmeadery.com. And so you can mail order it in many states, not all states, but you said 17 states, you can mail order it directly from you as well.
Right, and we have everything available on our website. So if the mead's in stock, it's on our website. Some of the meads that we ship nationwide only have six different SKUs. And, you know, as of, I don't know how long it's going to take to get to Queensland, Australia, but it heads out this week to Australia. So listeners and viewers can find it there as well.
So I actually have a lot of people listening in Australia, so that'll be great. I'm sure I'll have to tell them, start looking for your meads. Well, Michael, I really appreciate you being on the show. It's just fantastic to have you back, and always a pleasure to hear you talk about not only mead, but your success, pursuing your business here.
Well, pursuing your dream.
Do you have any closing comments? Is there anything else you want to add?
No, just, you know, for everybody that dreams about opening a brewery or meadery or winery out there, you know, find your courage, find your conviction and make it happen. Never let anybody tell you what can't be done. And yeah, if anybody ever has any questions, they can reach me at fairbrother@moonlightmeadery.com. And I'm always happy to answer emails and give advice that I can to homebrewers.
So you're ready to go back and take your day job again?
No, that's never going to happen.
That's never going to happen. Well, congratulations, Michael. It's great to have you on the show again. Today's guest was Michael Fairbrother. He is the head brewer, or I should say head mead maker at Moonlight Meadery. He's been making mead since 1995. He's won national, international awards, and you can visit his website at moonlightmeadery.com. Well, a big thank you to Michael Fairbrother for joining us from moonlightmeadery.com. Really appreciate him being here. A reminder to you can sign up for our newsletter at beersmith.com. Just go to the sidebar and we'll send you an article on homebrewing every week. Also, several of the guests have asked that if you have questions about brewing, homebrewing, mead making, whatever it is, feel free to send those in and I'll include those and use those during some of the shows. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.